D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch. Heute Perverting Trust mit Honora O'Neill. In unserer Reihe über das Vertrauen spricht heute die emeritierte Professorin Honora O'Neill von der Philosophischen Fakultät in Cambridge. Zuvor hatte sie Philosophie, Psychologie und Physiologie an der Universität Oxford studiert. Von 1992 bis 2006 war sie Direktorin des Newnham College in Cambridge. Sie hat sich vor allem mit einer großen Anzahl an Berichten über biomedizinische Themen befasst. O'Neill schreibt über ethische und politische Philosophie mit Schwerpunkten in internationaler Gerechtigkeit, der Philosophie Immanuel Kants sowie in Bioethik. Die 1941 geborene O'Neill zeigt uns in ihrem Vortrag auf, dass Fragebögen von Meinungsforschern meist nur empirische Aussagen zum Thema Vertrauen hervorbringen. Diese sagten aber nur wenig darüber aus, ob wir nicht doch einzelnen Politikern und einzelnen Journalisten vertrauen, selbst wenn wir die jeweils gesamte Branche als vertrauensunwürdig einstufen. Wie könne es sonst sein, dass Bürger angeben, kaum Vertrauen in die Polizei und Lebensmittelindustrie zu haben, dann aber doch im Notfall die Polizei rufen und im Supermarkt umfänglich einkaufen? Eine große Kluft zwischen den Aussagen der Befragten und ihren Handlungsweisen stelle sie immer wieder fest, so O'Neill. Diese erst jüngst entstandene Kultur des Misstrauens gegenüber bestimmten Gruppen müsse in den nächsten Jahren unbedingt verändert werden, was aber alles andere als leicht sei. Dazu also nun Perverting Trust.
Well, I think I owe you all a bit of an apology for this title. The ancestor of this paper, a slightly remote ancestor given where it's got to now, was something I was writing and I was rung up, I've got to have a title now. So I said, okay, Perverting Trust. And somehow, in spite of its misleading connotations, I've stuck with it. I think it's a bit misleading because it probably suggests I'm going to talk about people who have betrayed trust, about, for example, politicians or journalists or social workers or bankers. And there have been a lot of problems in all of those cases. But what I'm actually going to do is to try to take a more practical take on trust than I think most people do. I think, actually, that the perversion of trust that I'm going to talk about lies a bit deeper than the particular numerous terrible betrayals of trust that we have seen, and that they are built into some of the standard ways in which we think about trust, discuss trust, and, as it is often, and I think somewhat misleadingly put, try to build trust. I think some of the things that we're doing there actually systematically undermine trust. So that's why I think it's a deeper perversion, but I won't be talking much about perversion, actually. Now, I think if we put it very succinctly, but this is all from a practical point of view, the practical problem is pretty simple. Trust can be misplaced. It's a success term, but we don't, as it were, build in the assumption of success as we do with the term knowledge. So our problem is that the trustworthy may be mistrusted and the untrustworthy may be trusted. And those two mismatches are at the heart of the practical problem, and, of course, they lead to a lot of anxiety, but they also, I think, lead to intellectual complexity. To spell it out, if we refuse to trust the trustworthy, we incur a lot of worry and cost trying to check them out and hold them to account and discover more. Or we feel we're greatly at risk. But meanwhile, those who think that their trustworthiness has been wrongly questioned are, of course, cross, undermined, insulted, and ultimately they feel inclined to be less trustworthy. What's it worth if I'm still mistrusted? And on the other hand, and it's better known because people talk about this so much more, when we trust the untrustworthy, we might find our trust is betrayed, we might lose what we staked, friendship, political aims, money. So I believe, and here I'm, I think, very much with Russell Hardin, that trustworthiness rather than trust should be our first concern. To use an old-fashioned sexist metaphor, it is trustworthiness that wears the trousers. Now, for our central practical aim in placing and refusing trust is, of course, to do it well. We want to succeed. We want to align trust with trustworthiness. But, as Russell also said, proofs of trustworthiness aren't available. Trust is fundamentally a response to others under conditions of some uncertainty. By the way, I think uncertainty is rather more relevant than risk here. It's better to have the more generic notion. It's a matter of deciding to rely on others' claims and commitments, and again, I think it's important to have both, their truth claims and their commitments for action, or perhaps just their institutional commitments. It's placing trust in claims and commitments with incomplete evidence. Now, proceeding without complete evidence is unavoidable and it's not irrational. Just as we constantly have to place and refuse belief on the basis of incomplete rather than conclusive evidence, we constantly have to place or refuse trust on the basis of incomplete rather than conclusive evidence. But incomplete evidence isn't the same as complete absence of evidence. Blind trust, given in the absence of any evidence, is sometimes rightly criticized, just as blind credulity, given in the absence of evidence, is often criticized as mere superstition. The central practical question, I think it parallels many questions in epistemology, is how to place trust intelligently despite the inevitable incompleteness of evidence that others' words are true of the world or that their acts will live up to the world. That's to say, the claims and the commitments. Now, I hope that's all in a way uncontroversial, just articulating our ordinary problems in placing and refusing trust. But unfortunately, I think a lot of discussions of trust and trust building in public life, in the media, and indeed in some academic quarters, marginalise practical questions. They're less concerned with the intelligent placing and refusal of trust that aims to align trust with trustworthiness than with empirical questions about the levels of response, about the levels of trust actually found. Most obviously, and I'll take this as my example, what pollsters do. They ask us whom we trust, and in particular how much we trust certain types of actor, often professionals or office holders, sometimes institutions. Politicians, journalists, doctors, judges, teachers, you've read the stuff. In particular, they ask a lot, how much do you trust them to tell the truth? So they tend to emphasise a rather generic version of the truth claim problem. Now, those polls have become standard fare in the public and professional life of contemporary democracies. And the findings are, as you all know, well publicised and actually, let's face it, widely enjoyed. People like this stuff. In the UK, to give you some examples, in 2011, 92% said they would trust doctors to tell the truth. That actually was about GPs. Teachers did pretty well, 88%, professors 80%, judges 80%, not bad. But by contrast, down at the bottom we have, as always, the politicians, the ministers and the journalists. At present, the politicians are at a bit of an ebb at 13%, but they've never been very high, up to 20% sometimes. Government ministers are down to 16 from 24. A remarkable, but I think too little remarked upon feature of these poll findings on trust levels is that they're actually pretty stable across time, and I hope to try to explain why. Journalists are nearly always between 10 and 20% in the UK. They do a bit better elsewhere, different media cultures. Politicians are nearly always between 14 and 21%. Doctors between 82 and 92%. That, of course, isn't what's widely believed, and it isn't what the media report. They report percentage changes, sometimes on these very low percentages. And, of course, there are dips and peaks, not to mention variations that you get by varying the questions or by the prominence of particular so-called stories. Some of them may really be stories in the media. Why the stability? I think it's because pollsters ask us empirical questions about generic attitudes to typical holders of professional and public roles. They don't ask us about attitudes to, let alone judgments, of individual professionals or office holders, apart from a few polls that focus on individual politicians. But when did you last answer a poll on how much you trusted the head of the European Bank? They don't either ask about trust in specific matters. So, of course, poll results can't offer an accurate or discriminating view even of levels of trust in individuals, because individuals may be more or less trusted than others holding the same role. Nor can they tell us whether someone is more or less trusted for specific tasks than the average holder of the same type of role. I may have little trust in journalists or politicians, but rather high trust in particular ones that, whom I judge honest and reliable. You may have high trust in doctors and teachers, but mistrust a certain teacher or doctor whom you know to have failed in some way. Attitudes to individuals who hold certain positions, individual doctors, politicians, even individual fellow citizens, are often highly differentiated, and they do not match the undifferentiated attitudes expressed by the same informants about the generality of those holding such positions. Now, I think that any penetrating account of trust, indeed even an adequate account of trust, would need to take account of the differentiation. A typical reason for it is just that something distinguishes a particular case from other cases. So it is actually very unlikely that asking questions that are designed to bracket the differentiation will cast any light on the differences between the different cases. Polls that ask questions about types of office holders and professionals have to ask about generic attitudes. It's not just that they do, they have to. Not about informed or even uninformed judgments of individual office holders or professionals, or judgments about their trustworth in particular matters. That focus on attitudes to typical cases for the whole range of activities simply marginalizes the very matters that we take most seriously if we seek to place and refuse trust intelligently. It looks at trust without taking any view of the evidence for trustworthiness or untrustworthiness. It looks at the response while, as it were, skewing the way in which the response is to be constructed. In this art form, misplaced mistrust counts as much as well-placed mistrust, and misplaced trust counts as much as well-placed trust. To generalize, judgments discriminate, so they aim to be evidence-based. Attitudes generalize, they can float largely free of specific evidence. This makes it easy and relatively cheap to find out about attitudes of trust and mistrust, but the ease has a cost. Neither polls nor more deliberative empirical investigations of public attitudes provide us with useful evidence, or indeed really any evidence, about trustworthiness. That's just a corollary of the fact I started with, that we can hold suspicious attitudes to the trustworthy and credulous ones to the untrustworthy, often to our own detriment. Indeed, we can hold these attitudes while making quite different judgments. When I gave the Reith Lectures on Trust in 2002, one of the lectures was given at the clinical school at Addenbrookes. There were a number of patients in the audience, and this lady in the wheelchair got the mic, and she said, "I don't trust surgeons, and what is worse, my operation has been postponed for 3 weeks." Had I not thought this is all being recorded, I might have said, "Well, you must be so delighted since you don't trust surgeons," but I had to flannel. I think all this is just a strange situation to have got to, and I just remind you of some recent examples of misplaced trust and mistrust. This is not, as it were, a small problem. For example, the people who trusted the well-named Mr. Madoff with their savings, who then made off with the money, and the people who refused to trust the MR vaccine, who exposed the large number in the UK and I think also in Germany, who exposed their own and others' children to an unnecessary risk of measles, have very clearly defined attitudes. That's easy to measure. But we have to say they placed their trust and mistrust rather poorly. Misplaced trust and misplaced mistrust are both very common, and an intelligent account of trust would need to consider not merely the attitudes people evince when we poll them, but whether those attitudes are based on intelligent judgments of the relevant other's trustworthiness and untrustworthiness. So let me say a bit about examples and evidence. I've said that I think we need to begin with trustworthiness and untrustworthiness. But while an empirical study of trustworthiness would actually be far more useful to help us placing and refusing trust intelligently, it is, of course, far harder. It's difficult to find out about trustworthiness and untrustworthiness in the first place because the untrustworthy have to mask their deceit, their unreliability, and their incompetence. That is to say, you know, open untrustworthiness tends not to work. Nevertheless, commentators often make very confident claims about who is and who is not trustworthy. Well, how do they know? They typically make these claims and support them by pointing to supposedly compelling examples of untrustworthy action, and then suggesting that such untrustworthiness is just normal. And there are always vivid examples of recent untrustworthiness, but I don't think they provide generalizable evidence. If they did, after all, a parallel inference from instances of trustworthy action, also always to hand, or the general trustworthiness of an office holder or professional should carry some weight. But the two unreliable lines of inference are usually viewed quite differently. Commentators seldom point to compelling examples of trustworthiness in public and professional life to vindicate a conviction that all office holders or professionals of that type are trustworthy. I don't think this is because they think there is no trustworthy performance. I suspect it's probably because they think, tacitly, that trustworthiness is unremarkable, normal, not worth recording, let alone applauding. Untrustworthy performance thereby gets the limelight and attention. Trustworthy performance is taken for granted. So I think the underlying problem is real. We often know rather little about levels of trustworthiness and untrustworthiness in public and professional life, and it's genuinely hard to place and refuse trust intelligently. While the empirical claims about attitudes of trust are pretty easy to establish, empirical claims about levels of trustworthiness are hard to establish. We, of course, tell ourselves stories about the golden post-war age. How true are they? Well, big question. But it's the latter, namely the evidence of trustworthiness, that we need for practical purposes. And it isn't possible to infer levels of trustworthiness sort of backwards from levels of trust, because they don't need to vary together. Trusting, in short, isn't like following or ignoring fashion. If that's what you want to do, look at what other people are wearing, and it will give you some good evidence. If you want to dress fashionably or unfashionably, look around quickly and discover what people are wearing. But when we place or refuse trust, we need to find at least some evidence to judge others' trustworthiness, and the evidence of third parties' attitudes of trust and mistrust is a remarkably poor substitute. In most cases, I might talk about some exceptions. Our practical aim is, I think, to place trust well, not to place it like lemmings. The social and political currents that lie behind our current obsession with empirical questions about levels of trust, I think, pervert serious thought about the practical task of placing trust well by trying to align it with trustworthiness. So let me now turn to the practical task after being a bit polemical. From a practical point of view, what matters are not the typical attitudes, but success in placing trust in the trustworthy and refusing it to the untrustworthy. Doing so can be hard if the available evidence is meagre, complex, conflicting, or misleading. It would, after all, be very hard and probably impossible if we needed to judge the overall trustworthiness of types of office holder or professional, or the overall trustworthiness of individual office holders or professional. Again, this point has been touched on this morning. But luckily, that's not what we usually need. We don't usually need to make judgments of overall trustworthiness for all purposes, or to judge the trustworthiness of whole professions or of all office holders of a type. More often, we need to judge whether specific claims or commitments made by particular individuals, office holders, or institutions are trustworthy. For example, to bring us down to earth, we may need to judge whether A's claim about an accident in which his car was damaged is true, or whether B's promise to pay for the damage to A's car is reliable. In judging whether to trust others' claims and commitments, we typically need, and we can usually find, some evidence of their honesty, reliability, and competence. And by the way, I don't think of judgments of trust as judgments of reliability. I think that these other considerations are also highly important, and I mentioned honesty and competence there. Every day, however, we manage to do this for practical purposes with reasonable success. This morning already, you've probably placed your trust in other motorists and pedestrians, shopkeepers and colleagues, friends and family. It is something we always are having to do. But it will be said those are the easy cases, and of course that's why I dealt with them first. It's one thing to judge honesty, reliability and competence in daily life, much harder in public and professional life, where we encounter institutions that are opaque and expertise that is arcane and interact with strangers whom we can observe in limited ways, if at all. What we need, we will say, are some practical remedies for those difficulties. Now, the standard remedy is to try to institutionalize ways of judging things, to construct indirect ways by which we can judge honesty, reliability, and competence. Intelligent shoppers, for example, may decide to trust a computer firm if they can judge the product specification, the brand name, and the guarantee, perhaps. Intelligent savers may mistrust retail banks if they make too many mistakes, market incomprehensible products, or can't answer sensible questions. I say nothing about investment banks. Now, these indirect ways of judging others' trustworthiness up to a point help us assess the claims and commitments made by experts, institutions, officials, or professionals, even if we can't judge their honesty, reliability, or competence directly. Remedies of this sort have been in use for centuries, and they've proliferated in virtually all areas of public and professional life in the last 25 years. I think they have proliferated, but they have not been as useful as people imagine. This hasn't certainly changed the common view that we have a crisis of trust, or the separate common view that this must reflect a crisis of trustworthiness. The commonly prescribed remedy for these problems has been to say we need accountability and some more accountability and some more. So let's think a bit about accountability. Ideally, systems of accountability are meant to provide systematic but indirect evidence for judging trustworthiness in public and professional life.
Perverting Trust senden wir heute in unserer Reihe aus dem Einstein Forum Berlin, das vom 4. November dieses Jahres stammt. Rednerin ist die britische Gelehrte und Philosophin Honora O'Neill. Nach unserem kurzen Jingle geht's gleich schon wieder weiter.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Accountability is a matter of defining and then imposing, enforcing second-order obligations to provide some account or evidence of the standard to which the basic first-order professional or official duties or tasks have been discharged. And more exacting standards of accountability have been very widely demanded and introduced in public and professional life. I think the situation in the UK may be typical of developed societies. Some say an example of excess. I'm not sure I could judge that. But we have a great deal in place. The Nolan Principles for Conduct in Public Life, numerous requirements for institutional report and audit, more stringent professional qualifications codes and requirements for continuous professional development. performance against targets, increased regulatory supervision, requirements for forms of transparency, requirements for public consultation when numerous decisions are made. There's a panoply of forms of accountability. Now, these multiple and intricate approaches to holding people and institutions to account are said to have two aims. They're supposed to create incentives for more trustworthy performance and, of course, sanctions for untrustworthy performance, and maybe they do. They're also supposed to provide evidence that allows the less expert to place and refuse trust beyond daily life with more discrimination. So I think there are two practical questions to ask about any proposal to strengthen accountability in public and professional life. First, does it improve trustworthiness? Seems rather important. Second, does it help individuals to place and refuse trust intelligently? Now, in my view, many current approaches to accountability fail on one or both accounts. So let me talk a bit about defective forms of accountability. Because it's hard to judge levels of trustworthiness, it's actually pretty hard to tell how well favoured forms of accountability that are meant to hold professionals and office holders to account are working. Do they improve trustworthiness? Hard to say sometimes. Certainly they don't always do so, so I'll start from the negative end. Some approaches to accountability clearly undermine rather than improve trustworthiness. Setting inappropriate targets, then sanctioning those who find it hard to meet them can, as we all know, create perverse incentives. Those who seek to meet the targets find that they need to game the system. They may, for example, embrace a tick-box culture at the expense of genuine improvement of performance. In other cases, the incentives may not be quite perverse, but they can still be highly damaging. Systems of accountability create damaging incentives that obstruct good performance more indirectly when they require office holders and professionals to follow procedures that hinder performance of their primary tasks. I'm afraid there's quite a lot of that too. Now, there are other, no doubt, more intelligent approaches to accountability that help. Let's remind ourselves there isn't much of a movement to abolish financial audit for companies. We may think it's not enough and it's not very good, and it's sobering to remember that most of the financial institutions that failed in 2008 had nice, clean audits. I'm sure they had very nicely maintained risk registers too. Nor is there much enthusiasm for ending requirements to declare interests and stand down when there's a conflict of interest, at least in some societies, though there's understandably some scepticism about how well those requirements are observed. But the patchy record of systems of accountability in securing trustworthy performance seems to me something that it would be far more useful to study, looking at their impact on trustworthiness, than it is to survey public trust either by polling or more deliberative methods. Such work's more difficult, but it would be a better use of time and money than barking repeatedly up the trees that don't matter for practical purposes. So, have we actually succeeded in achieving rising accountability with declining trust? That would be sort of interesting if we've reached that situation. I don't know. One of the difficulties is that the information assembled in order to hold office holders and institutions, professions to account, usually doesn't offer a usable, let alone a user-friendly basis for judging where to place and where to refuse trust for specific purposes. Company and institutional reports and accounts are, as we all know, dry and complex reading. Adding pretty pictures hasn't made it easier to spot underlying problems. The accounts and the reports of companies, charities, public bodies become longer and longer and prettier and more expensive to produce and more trees, but it's no easier to judge. Professionalized, standardized forms of accountability, after all, we may say, are not designed to help the inexpert of us to place and refuse trust. They target trustworthiness with greater or lesser success, not trust. Now, that limitation has been pretty widely recognised, and the favoured remedy is to supplement formal accountability with more active ways of informing the inexpert, clients, patients, customers, the wider public, so that those who find the formal systems of accountability arid or unpalatable or incomprehensible can turn to a simplified but reliable picture as a basis for placing and refusing trust. Simplified selections from the information assembled by the formal systems of accountability are legion. Press releases, school league tables, other league tables, ratings of public services. They are certainly more comprehensible to most of us. But this comprehensibility is often at the expense of providing good evidence of trustworthiness. This is particularly glaring, I think, when the evidence is used to rank matters that are very complex. Rankings are comprehensible. Any of us can tell who comes top in a ranking, but they're very often misleading. For example, the OECD has the PISA rankings of national school systems on certain things, but they have so many internal difficulties and non-comparabilities, which you can discover just by going online, that they offer a blurred and probably inaccurate account of pupil attainment at various ages in OECD school systems. Or look at the World University rankings. This year, for the first time, they are more complete. We have rankings of all universities down to number 400, Saragossa, in case you wonder, which has been a university since the 16th century. They do it on numerous variables, but they are very careful not to look at the variables some of us might think most relevant to university quality. For example, they don't tell us how much the students work. They don't tell us what they could do when they were started at the university, and they don't tell us what they could do when they leave. Very interesting. Rankings are intelligible, but they're not going to be informative if the wrong things are measured, and there may be political reasons for not measuring the most sensitive things. I'll give you an example. Among British universities, the most selective universities, which have students whom one has reason to believe are most competent upon entry. They are also the students who work the hardest. And the difference between the number of hours people work at different universities and on different courses is stupendous. But that is glossed over by the World University rankings. The central oddity, then, I think, is that we find that we have increased requirements for accountability, and we claim we want more user-friendly public communication about performance, but it's not enough for placing and refusing trust intelligently. As I suggested, some failings might be due to poor design and implementation of systems of accountability, their perverse or damaging incentives, and others might be due to the poor quality of user-friendly public communication, such as it now is. But I think that's surely not the whole story. It flies in the face of so much evidence to respond to every example of misplaced trust, or, of course, of mistrust misplaced, by diagnosing a defective system of accountability or defective communication, then saying, so we need more. I think it's more plausible to think that the remedies are failing to address the problems they're supposed to correct, leaving us, of course, with widespread ignorance, and sometimes that translates as scepticism, occasionally as credulity, about others' trustworthiness. Larger doses of the remedy don't look particularly plausible. Well, a tempting thought is, could we do without trust? We could settle for accountability and say that is enough for securing better trustworthiness, but not, of course, for placing and refusing trust intelligently, but say, that's unimportant, doesn't matter. Perhaps we would say, ensuring that professionals and institutions are trustworthy is good enough, since it can ensure that people won't be harmed, even if they're very bad at placing and refusing trust. The other way to go would be to look more carefully at what we can and can't do to enable the intelligent placing and refusal of trust. Well, I think suggestion one can't work. We can't simply ignore trust and concentrate on trustworthiness in daily or public life. Trust matters because, to put it very simply, it matters for many other reasons, because it keeps transaction costs down. Where people can place and refuse trust in others' claims and commitments reasonably intelligently, interaction is more rapid and it's more pleasant. Relations of trust are pleasant and efficient. Costs mount staggeringly if you're going to seek guarantees for every transaction. Those formal guarantees, contracts, other forms of accountability, all of those, moreover, have ultimately, guess what, to be taken on trust, or we have an infinite regress. We therefore cannot expect to secure guarantees of the quality of every performance or contract, or certificates of compliance for every performance, or proof of the probity of those who draft all the relevant documents, without running into a regress of hyper-complexity that will defeat even the most energetic and well-informed of us and reduce all of us to credulity rather than allowing us to place and refuse trust intelligently. Even in societies with strong systems of accountability, people need to be able to judge when to trust and when to mistrust others' claims and commitments. So I think we can't just forget about trust. We can't do without it either in daily life or more generally. It would be like refusing to cross the road without information on the trajectory of distant vehicles that's accurate to several decimal points. We rightly call that sort of thing paranoia. And it's equally absurd to think we can eliminate trust from public and professional life. Although our ability to judge honesty, reliability, and competence is less secure in these situations, that's a problem we have to face, not hide. There's no other option. So I think that in public as in daily life, we need indirect but culturally robust surrogates on which to base judgment. And we will place trust poorly if those surrogates are poorly constructed, excessively complex, or let's face it, corrupt. Any thought that we can do without trust's a non-starter, so we've got to have, I think, both effective accountability and better evidence. Two practical questions then arise. First, could more intelligent approaches of accountability give us more trustworthy performance? And can we find a more useful way of enabling the intelligent placing and refusal of trust? I think the answer to both questions is probably a cautious yes, in principle. It's not inevitable that systems are hyper-complex and create perverse and damaging incentives, or that they obstruct professionals and office holders in their primary tasks. There's a lot that we know about systems of accountability, but there's a lot to find out. And none of it will be found out by looking for more and more empirical information about levels of public trust. But we could usefully seek to understand more systematically which forms of accountability seem to work reasonably well for which purposes. When is it important to align interests, and when is it important to institutionalise forms of contestation? When is it effective to split responsibility for governance, and when is it important to ensure that accountability doesn't run in multiple directions? What's the scope of the agent-principle problem? When do targets and arm's-length inspections backed by sanctions work? And when does a more formative approach to inspection deliver more? Which sorts of accountability are best achieved by cost control, by market disciplines, by performance management, by professional cultures? Which are damaged by each of these? It's a tiny sample of some of the practical questions we could try to answer. I think they point to an agenda for research that supports the practical task of enabling the intelligent placing and refusal of trust, which no amount of looking for empirical evidence of how people are now placing and refusing trust can do. And if we cannot do without trust, it's not going to be enough to look for better levels of trustworthiness and look for more adequate systems of accountability. We also need that usable evidence about others' claims and commitments, their honesty, their competence, their reliability. And that demand cuts very deep, and I think we've probably been heading in the wrong direction. It's common ground, at least, that it's not enough to provide obscure or unintelligible evidence, even if you provide lots and lots and lots of it. But then the disagreement sets in. There are those who now lay great weight on openness and transparency, and I can testify that criticising transparency gets one into trouble. I'm going to do it. Transparency limits secrecy, but it may not support trust. It's achieved by putting information in the public domain. Doing so doesn't ensure that those for whom the information might matter, for example, in placing or refusing trust, will find it or can follow it. Transparent dissemination of information often simply fails to communicate with relevant audiences. whether by using jargon small print, swamping others with irrelevant or poorly presented detail, demanding time and attention they don't have. There are lots of ways of doing it. Transparency is most useful for professionals or experts in the relevant field with the time, resource, and experience to find, read, and use, and perhaps to assess how it was selected and edited. It may be a useful component of accountability, but those who need to place and refuse trust often find out that first they have to work out whether to give or refuse trust to whichever third party, and it's often obscure, has selected, simplified, perhaps distorted the information. A public body, a media company, an activist, Transparency International, on and on. Transparency supports trust only for those who can find reason to trust the intermediaries who select and edit the information. Many of those intermediaries have their own agendas, and curiously enough, many of them come from the least regulated and least accountable sections of society, the media, the NGOs. This problem seems to me fundamental. We can't build trust by piling demands for transparency on top of systems of accountability. Trust isn't built, it's given or refused. Introducing intermediaries makes it more difficult because it requires trust first to be given to the intermediary. Think of various domains of life. Think about the role of the genetic counsellor, the so-called personal financial advisor. Think about the commercial offer. The intermediaries are, I think, supposedly making it easier for the public, but are actually part of the problem. Now, trust is more likely to be given and refused intelligently if intermediaries have a minimal interpretive or editorial, or let us say, inventive role, a role that can be assessed, and also if they're not interested parties, and it's rather sobering to reflect how many intermediaries are interested parties. So if we want to make it easier to place and refuse trust intelligently, there's much more than the provision of information we need to think about systematically. What can those who hope to be trusted provide that might help others to decide whether or not to trust them? You have, as it were, to lay yourself open if it's to be trusted at the end, not, as it were, run a PR campaign that persuades others that your brand is best. There are many possibilities. I think, for example, of exit strategies. One commercial strategy that has appeal is making it very easy to return defective goods, or even non-defective goods, unwanted goods. Go into Marks and Spencer's in the UK, choose the socks, you get them home, they think they're the wrong colour for your suit, take them back, get your money back. That leads people to trust the institution. It's an exit strategy. What about withdrawing from medical research? It was long ago spotted that that was an important strategy, that research participants can exit at any time. What, on the other hand, is the importance of providing for voice, ways of complaining or questioning those who carry primary obligations? What's the importance of recognising loyalty and being seen to do so? Each of these approaches, I think, has been well explored in some areas of commercial and public life, less so in others, and is exploited and corrupted in other areas. So I believe it's very urgent to explore systematically which approaches communicate evidence of trustworthiness that's intelligible, useful, checkable, and which don't. Now, while I wouldn't embrace the fantasies of deliberative democracy or demand more or more frequent direct real-time engagement with those in whom we may need to place and to refuse trust, I think that, in general, it is a good idea to provide real possibilities for some unmediated communication. It's this possibility that is telling. You can return the merchandise. You can talk to the manager, not to the telephone scripted conversation, rather than incessant actual two-way communication or interaction. Where it is possible to check or challenge claims and commitments, people are often quick and sophisticated about placing and refusing trust. People who open themselves to check and challenge provide, by that very fact, some evidence of trustworthiness. But if we're to place or refuse trust, we're going to need either the possibility of getting unmediated evidence of others' honesty, competence, and reliability, or mediated evidence where we can do that and can directly check and challenge. Increasing dependence on mediated and standardized forms of transparency and quasi-communication, pretenses of interaction and communication, I believe amplify and do not resolve the difficulties of placing and refusing trust intelligently. If we can't achieve possibilities of unmediated communication, I think prospects of an intelligent placing of trust are bleak. We may end up with systems that secure adequate trustworthiness, but we won't be offering intelligible evidence to those who need to work out where to place and refuse trust. We would, so to speak, have incurred the costs of trustworthiness, but we would have foregone the benefits of trust. And I believe that that is the situation of public institutions in a number of developed countries now. They've paid the cost of the systems of accountability, but they haven't found ways to be more trusted. Systems of accountability that aren't linked intelligible and usable evidence perhaps don't earn their keep. It matters. They're expensive beasts, and we need to see that they secure both a measure of trustworthiness, more we can't hope for, and some steps towards enabling the intelligent placing and refusal of trust. Thank you very much.
Fast eine Stunde lang unterhielten wir Sie heute mit der Philosophin Honora O'Neill. Sie sprach über ihr Thema Perverting Trust. Die Aufzeichnung hat das Einstein-Forum in Potsdam am 4. November 2011 für uns übernommen. Die Reihe über die internationale Tagung on Trust setzen wir am kommenden Montag fort.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.